from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on this morning's forum, journalist, author, and English professor Tom Zellner will join us. He's back from a rousing trip around the world entirely by rail. In his book, Train, Riding the Rails That Created the Modern World, he charts the history of the locomotive along the world's most important railways, from the birthplace of the steam engine in Cornwall, England, to the frigid stretches of the Trans-Siberian Railroad. We'll talk about his journey and we'll discuss the future of high-speed rail. So now we're all about trains, next on Forum, after this. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Tom Zellner joins us for the second Forum Hour, a former reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, a journalist, author, and also professor of English at Chapman College in Los Angeles. He's written a number of nonfiction books, including Uranium, which won the 2011 Institute of Physics Science Writing Award. And he recently published a book called Train, in which, according to Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Rose, he makes himself a veritable Walt Whitman of rail travel, taking a rail travel odyssey around the world and revealing the importance of trains in civilizations past, present, and future. He joins us in studio. Glad to have you here. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Actually, I want to begin by talking about your love of trains, because I was reminded almost nostalgically of guy I used to work with, a newsman named Steve Walsh, who was actually the son of Bill Walsh, who unfortunately passed away. But he loved trains, and he had a kind of obsession with trains that, forgive me, I think you have, which is brought to good bear and fruition in this book. But you start off talking about this woman on a train, a kind of a dark lady. I mean, she's sitting there, she's reading a book, she's crying, and becomes associated almost in a poetic way, really, with trains for you.
Something about that image got to the heart of it for me in a way that's nonverbal that I am utterly unable to explain. But it's the image that starts the book. It's a woman, reading a novel on a train in a snowstorm. It's Pennsylvania, and the light.
Same weather there now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, utterly typical. And the overhead light is sort of giving her this kind of chiaroscuro, if I'm pronouncing that right, kind of quality. And I wanted to go up and talk to her, but I was just too shy and dorky to do so. And something about just a woman crying in a snowstorm in Pennsylvania on a train was kind of this magical image. And I remember reading about William Faulkner getting the idea for The Sound and the Fury, with a mental image, a totally nonverbal thing.
Just Caddy in the Pear Tree.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
With her underpants stained with mud.
All that combines to create this amazing book. And, you know, this is by not in my trying to compare myself to William Faulkner, but only to sort of emphasize the importance of the nonverbal when it comes to verbal expression.
Oh, this is an ambitious book, though. I mean, admittedly, not Faulkner's Sound and the Fury by any means, but certainly an ambitious book in all that you cover, and I want to get into as much of it as we can here because it's rich and certainly worth talking about. But when somebody like Richard Rhodes, no less, talks about you as a veritable Walt Whitman of the rails and rail travel, you think literary of Faulkner. I think literary of Whitman, who said, locomotive, the symbol of the modern. And indeed, it is a symbol of the modern. I mean, as you pretty much bring to bear in your book, it has more to do with the making of America than just about anything one can think of.
It was the first machine of the United States. It was what gave us our continental reach. And 19th century orators went to town on the train as being the engine of prosperity, this tool of manifest destiny. And it is a vehicle that lends itself to poetics in a way that even exceeds that of certainly the automobile and even the airplane.
Unless you read Frank Norris, which is all about
that. That's dark poetics.
And I was struck by, this is almost charming in a way. I know Lancaster, Ohio, because I lived for a number of years in southern Ohio. You get all this excitement and merchants in America and Europe beginning to pool their finances to connect their cities and villages to the grand colossus of new tracks. But when the school board in Lancaster, Ohio, received a request to let a classroom be used for a chartering meeting, the official response was this. This is in Tom Zellner's book. If God had designated that his intelligent creatures should travel at the frightful speed of 15 miles an hour, he would have foretold it through his holy prophets. And when they started seeing trains, I mean, you capture this in the first train in England. I mean, people were looking, you know, kind of mesmerized and hypnotic and frightened, too.
They could not understand what they were seeing. It had no organizing place in the consciousness. And so there were multiple press reports in Britain and in England. Whenever the locomotive was first put on the tracks, the coal was first lighted and the steam engine began to work, the smoke began to chuff, people going catatonic almost with
vacant stares,
disbelief, yes, and running away screaming. It was thought that the sight of this thing, it looked like a thing that was alive, you know, and there's certainly something about the steam engine that mimics respiration. It seems like it's going to, you know, rise up like an animal. And there was speculation that the sight of this would cause mother's milk to dry up, for them to go infertile. There was some thought in India that riding the train would actually subtract years from your life. It was seen as like a kind of a time travel machine. There nothing like it had been seen before.
Well, you know, as you point out, also it's kind of in some people's minds this lost American vehicle. I mean, the big locomotive, our ancestors, you talk about perhaps our past selves. But the fact of the matter is that it's still so much commerce is contingent upon trains to this day, maybe even more, one could argue, in recent years, and the eighth largest employer in the world.
Indian Railways. The only few organizations that exceed it are the U.S. Department of Defense and the Chinese Liberation Army.
when you get into the whole history of trains, you're also getting into the sense of that debut. It's what, 1825, Stockton and Darlington?
The first scheduled railway,
yeah.
Yes.
The fact of the matter is, as you say, people were finding it very difficult to get used to this monstrous industrial engine that would become essentially, the veins and arteries of so many countries in terms of commerce, in terms of trade. You actually, I know you love literature, so you get us into Walden Pond, but you also get even, let's move forward, you got the two Thoreaus. You got Paul Thoreau and Henry David Thoreau here, because Paul Thoreau, and this inspired you, I guess, to go on this extraordinary journey that you went on to try all the rails throughout the world.
Yes. You mentioned Paul Theroux. His enormous contribution to world letters was this idea of talking to passengers randomly, because anyone who's ridden a train knows the utter randomness of who you're going to be talking to, and using that as
stranger on a train.
There it is. No more romantic encounters occur on trains as they do.
Well, maybe if you talk to that woman who was holding the book, it could have been a different story.
Exactly. And there are days I wish it had, actually. Theroux came up with this idea of sort of literature through conversation on a train, and of getting a metaphor of a nation through its train systems. It's a wonderful model to follow. I tried to get more into social history, get more into the mechanics of the train, to have sort of a total, you know, narrative understanding, if such a thing is even possible, of where the power lies in this machine and continues to propel nations forward.
Well, there is a kind of railroad revival. I mean, Amtrak has the highest passenger rate they've had. As I said, more retail goods are being shipped by train.
They're almost making money.
They're almost making money, exactly. And you kind of have a brief here about energy and how the environment would be helped if only we would go back to the future where trains are concerned.
Yeah. I mean, a train is kind of like a broom or a hammer. It's just like one of these really sort of elegant, very simple designs that you can't really do too much to improve it. You know, smooth wheels on smooth metal rails is a way to coast enormous weight and to move tons and tons of goods. You know, to talk about the historical importance of this, this was really the birth of the land-borne commodities economy. You know, this is a way that cities could be founded on a plane as opposed to on some sort of waterway.
You also like the high-speed rail? I mean, the proposal of Governor Brown, L.A. and San Francisco?
You know, I'm a cautious supporter of that, a romantic realist, I think. You know, there's a lot of sort of utopian thinking around it. There's a lot of bitter opposition. The facts show that high-speed trains can work under certain conditions and under certain circumstances. And California is not perfect, but I think this is a good place to debut this technology in America.
Well, if we're going to lay tracks and move forward with this technology in America, we're going to have a lot of catching up to do. As you point out, you got about 292 billion high-speed network of trains now in China. They're way ahead of us.
They are. There are sort of cautionary examples of what China did in a particular Chinese way, Chinese communist way, that are not going to be suitable for California. Certainly, it's inspirational. I wouldn't necessarily want to have a rollout, if you like, of that speed and, in a sense, of that economic recklessness in China, as you know, I'd like here.
But you would like to see a railroad revival, and there's been some of that in Spain. There's been certainly in Japan. I was struck by a statistic I learned from your book that it's been half a century now for those bullet trains in Japan. They've had no fatal crashes.
Yeah, the only fatality on the Shinkansen was when somebody was killed by a sliding door. No crashes on the Shinkansen. It's a tremendous safety record.
But you do a great job of bringing so much to our attention about the culture about trains, and I mean, associated with so much that we could talk about for hours, and that is crystallized in your book. The book again is just called Train. But I want to get in before we talk about somewhat about train culture and some of the stories you tell. Talk about your trip, because you know, you did it. I mean, you went all around the world virtually.
Yeah, and
including up to Tibet, where the highest plateau is of all.
Yeah, the highest railroad in the world, and back on China, you know, that is another railroad that was designed not so much for economic purposes, but for political reasons, and for those who, you know, agitate for Tibetan independence, Tibetan autonomy. The train there was very bad news. This really kind of forecloses the question almost of a free and separate Tibet.
Although the worst news, as far as trains, probably in some ways, is one of those countries most dependent on trains, and that's India. And you have one of these rail guys that you portray for us, who actually, it's his job to take care of the rails. What hard work that is! Monumentally hard work.
Oh yeah, the railway is anywhere is going to require tremendous physical effort to maintain the network. And India has a particular problem, which is troublesome. It's sort of public sanitation in major cities, and the railway is the tracks are often used as a place to go to the bathroom. This is just the nature of life, and this poses a particular maintenance problem for the railway.
We talk about maintenance problems in Richmond. There are maintenance problems of all sorts that do come into the picture. But you went let me just trace this. I think you went across Britain first, started in Britain, then you went to India, yeah, across the United States, Russia from the Trans-Siberian Railroad, which is part of Tsar Alexander III's and the bullet trains of China, which we mentioned, then up to Tibet, in the Andes in Peru, and Spain. I think I've pretty much covered your topography, most of your itinerary.
Oh, it could have gone on and on. If I didn't have a deadline on this book, I'd still be on the rail somewhere.
So, love riding the rails and love just being on a train. You like the sights, of course, like anybody riding rails. I mean, I remember when I took trains in Spain, and I just loved seeing the Spanish countryside, thinking Hemingway, of course, and all that. But it's also, for you, it's the sounds. It's something almost blissful about it.
Oh, yes. There's an incredible sensory effect of riding the railway. You know, it's the slow passing of the landscape. It's sort of the tidal movement of the carriages. And it's the humanity within that carriage. It is a vehicle that's built for conversation. You have the greatest chance of meeting a stranger and of finding something in common with someone very different from you on a train, far more than you would on a bus and certainly on an airplane, which is, to me, a sterile and kind of pinched environment.
Have you had a chance to familiar with the story by Mary Gaitskill about strangers on a plane?
You know, I did read that story. She told it in a way that only Mary Gaitskill could, actually.
It's a very compelling story. But so is all the culture, again, to get back to that. I mean, Tolstoy and Gandhi and Walt Disney, there are all kinds of connections to railroads and American music. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. When you listen to popular music in America today, whether you realize it or not, you are listening to the railroad. You're listening to the particular sounds of the railroad. And why this is because of the antecedents of the Mississippi Blues, which is the granddad of rock and roll. And this was field calls done by the sharecroppers and the slaves in the Mississippi Delta at a particular time when the railroad was entering sort of the audio consciousness of humanity. You know, we talked earlier about the psychic shock that the railroad brought to the eyes. Well, it also, you know, was something new to the ears. It was a rhythmic, mechanistic, kind of a relentless beat. And so you marry that with field calls in the sort of sweltering Mississippi Delta, and you get a particular sound of music which had never been heard before. W.C. Handy, regarded as one of the pioneers of this movement, talked eloquently about the influence of the railroad on that sound, the Mississippi Blues, which, you know, speeded up became the city blues in Chicago and in St. Louis, these great railroad towns. And so it's impossible, really, to imagine what American music would sound like without the train. And by the way, I want to say, not just as an audio influence, but as a subject, so many wonderful songs about the railroad.
I'm going to lay my head down on that lonesome railroad line. Let the 219 train ease my pacify my troubled mind. Yeah. But we'll go on and on. Someone's in the kitchen with Dinah, strumming on the old banjo. Oh, by the way, I wanted to say when you were talking about India rails, I know I had a stray thought there. They're the most dangerous, really, aren't they?
They are incredibly dangerous, yes. But on a scale of danger, they're sort of in the middle.
But getting back to culture, I mean, you talk about the railroads and how they're related to romance and how they're related to sex and death, too.
Oh, yeah. Victorian writers of the 19th century saw a dynamo of sexual energy within the train. It became a symbol of the glory and of the fright of the sexual encounter. Absolutely.
And death?
Death.
Yeah. I was thinking about there's a Willa Cather story called Paul's Case, which you may know also. He lays down on a railroad. I mean, ultimately, the kid is very messed up and probably pathological, but that's how he decides to commit suicide. And there's a lot of, not only just because of the power of the railroad, but we had a whole discussion about the Golden Gate Bridge as a kind of magnet of suicide. Railroads have been magnets of suicide, and rails have been magnets of suicide, too.
Yeah, for reasons of logistics, certainly. It's kind of a foolproof way to do yourself in. And there's also a symbolism to it. No writer more than Leo Tolstoy grasped the sort of sex and death dynamic of the train.
You mean in Anna Karenina?
In Anna Karenina, yeah. Which the train is obviously where Anna meets her lover, Vronsky. And it's ultimately the train in which she under which she throws herself in one of the most famous scenes of Russian literature. Sorry for the spoiler there.
But there's a lot of hobos associated with the trains, too, of course, a whole hobo culture.
Yeah, yeah. Part of the outlaw mystique of the train, exemplified by the hobo, petty crimes, but also grand crimes, exemplified by Jesse James.
Train robberies.
Yes.
Yeah. All that, and just so much with that. In fact, we're going to bring our listeners into this conversation about trains and what kind of associations you have with them and train lore and really not only the past and present where trains are concerned, but also the future. I'd like you to talk about Henry Miggs, though, because this is a local story. This is a San Francisco con artist, and it's quite a story, actually.
Yeah, yeah. This is a shout-out to an old San Francisco scoundrel, Henry Miggs, who got a bunch of people to pay for a long kind of pier extended out half a mile into the bay from what's now Fisherman's Wharf. It was a total fraud. Meigs pocketed the booty there. And then when he was found out, got on board a ship in the middle of the night bound for South America, and the papers of San Francisco just had a field day on this guy. I called him, you know, the villain of the darkest stain, and all these under Victorian epithets. Henry Meigs went to Peru and convinced the government there to let him build this somewhat ridiculous railroad up the slope of the Andes. And unlike the thing in San Francisco, he actually did get a start on this. And in the process, it led to the deaths of many Chinese laborers, many Chilean laborers. You know, Meigs, of course, made sure that a lot of the money went into his own pockets, and he left the railroad half finished. It exists today. The Grace fortune, W.R. Grace, finished this railroad. And it's today a cargo road, which I was allowed to ride on the prow of a locomotive, which was quite a thrill. They usually don't let you up there, but I got to do it.
Because?
The
journalistic credentials?
Yeah, I don't know why. The guy who owns this railroad, half owns this railroad, is from Pittsburgh. And he let me do it, which would have given the risk management guys at Union Pacific probably a heart attack to see someone on the front of one of their locomotives. But it was a ride like none other.
And Meigs is almost forgotten. Like you say, there was such a fuss made of him in his own time. I mean, but now he's kind of obscured by the passage of time.
Yeah, definitely not the only con man to come from San Francisco.
Again, we're talking with Tom Zellner, and his book is called Train, and it's about riding the rails that created the modern world. You can say that the key to making America and shaping society was indeed, in so many ways, the railroad and its history. But I also want to not only hear from you, our listeners, about your thoughts with respect to railroads. And we asked on Facebook that you let us know about perhaps the most memorable trip you've taken on a train or on a rail, and what comes to mind with that? Again, if you have a story, we'd love to hear it. Be brief, succinct, but feel free to join us in discussion about trains and also what you envision about trains of the future. I mean, certainly we've had a lot of debates, obviously, about high-speed rail in California between Los Angeles and San Francisco, but trains would certainly do a lot for the problems we have now that we face with climate change. We could go back to the future, as I said, and have trains be more a part of passenger riding. Let me invite you to join us. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786, and we do want to hear from you, so feel free to join the program. Again, you can do that now toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also let us know your thoughts or any questions or comments you have by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post your questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. We're hearing the St. Louis Blues, of course, by W.C. Handy. Tutwiler Train Station in Mississippi is reportedly where he first heard a man play the blues on a slide guitar. Again, we welcome your thoughts, your questions, your comments. Talking with Tom Zellner, who will be at the Town Center Books in Pleasanton this evening at 7 o'clock. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Tom Zellner. He's back from a trip around the world entirely by rail. And in his book, Train, Riding the Rails That Created the Modern World, he charts the history of the locomotive along the world's most important railways, from the birthplace of the steam engine in Cornwall, England, to the frigid stretches of the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Talking about his journey with him, talking about rail, about future of railroads, as well as the past, and so much of Western civilization is obviously built on railroads. He'll be at Town Center Books in Pleasanton this evening at 7 o'clock, and we go to our callers. Gwendolyn, good morning.
Hi, I have memories of my father, my mother actually putting me on the train to see my father in Wisconsin. She lived in Kentucky. And I was wondering if the author had any information that he put about the Pullman Porters, because that was the first organized group of African Americans, and they preceded the NAACP and Urban League.
Yes, A. Philip Randolph was a Pullman Porter and a pivotal figure in labor history.
A. Philip Randolph, a leader of the NAACP.
Yes, yes, yes. And the railroad was tremendously important to African Americans, not merely as employment, but also as a means of migration up from the South to the—
Well, the Underground Railroad, as it was called, but it was simply the way of escaping by following, you know, the stars, literally. But for African Americans in general, I was actually mentioning to Tom off air that teaching a story by Richard Wright soon about a young kid who escapes from the South. I mean, makes his migration north. He gets in some trouble, and he's in Mississippi. And again, it's the locomotive. It's the railroad by which they were able to tell time, too, you know, in many instances.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about the railroad as a metaphor for sex, a metaphor for death. The greatest metaphor of all, however, is one of escape. And that's a way to get on that iron horse and ride your troubles away.
And Gwendolyn, thank you for that call about Pullman Porters. Let me go to some more calls, and we'll go to Susan next. Susan, you're on.
Hi, good morning. What a wonderful program. I remember taking the train with my mom from Chicago to New Orleans, and we had our cat in our little cabin there, and the porter came in and made up our beds, and we weren't supposed to have the cat, but he let us keep it. I never forget that kindness. But the other anecdote I want to share with you is we rode the trains in the Czech Republic before the wall came down. And there was only one man handling everything, tickets, the dining car, and he had a big wallet like an accordion. And in every space was the currency for each country you went through. And the only food that he had were eggs and jam. So all night long he made crepes for everyone in the dining car, and everyone just sat there and ate crepes and drank, and it was just an incredible experience, and a world that's gone, but wonderful, and your book totally brings it back. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call, Susan. Good to hear from you, and she reminded me of a train I took from Prague to Berlin, and like so many European trains, and like for longtime American trains, there was such class distinctions. I mean, where you sat and what kind of perks you got and what kind of service you got?
Certainly. The class structure was replicated on the railroads, but another countervailing force was the way that it broke down class structures and allowed people to talk to one another who ordinarily would not be talking. And it's no surprise, I think the caller's name was Susan, that she mentions the kindness of the porters and of the stewards. And that lives on in America today. You know, Amtrak does a lot of things wrong, and it certainly takes a certain sense of humor to ride Amtrak and to deal with the numerous delays. But one thing that it does have is, in my view, a real good-heartedness on the part of the porters and the stewards and those employees that you run into.
Again, Tom Zellner is the author of Train, and Don in San Ramon writes us, you can still ride vintage trains, steam and diesel, on weekends in the Bay Area at Niles Canyon Railway. Additionally, they will have 5 steam locomotives operating at their Steam Fest in June, and our engineer, Danny Bringer's parents, are volunteer workers on Niles Canyon Railway. Let's get that in. And we did a program, actually, from Train Museum up in Sacramento a number of years ago. There's lots to see there. I mean, for those of you who are train lovers like Tom Zellner, Ben asks, what was your guest's favorite train to sleep on? When I backpacked around Europe, the sleeper cars in Italy were so great.
Favorite train to sleep on? I'm going to say not the Trans-Siberian. That was not restful. I'm actually going to go for, in this case, the Southwest Chief in the United States. I've just sort of picked on Amtrak a little, but there's no more, in my view, more comfortable, sort of alluring way to sort of drift off than with the Mojave Desert behind the blue curtains.
More of your calls. We go to Dan Richard. Morning.
Good morning. I really appreciate the program. I'm looking forward to reading the book. And I'm the chair of the High Speed Rail Authority. We are going to build high speed rail in California. But I was going to say my most memorable train trip was going around Europe with my son. We rode the Orient Express, but when we were on the trains in Switzerland, I suddenly realized that I could hear my watch ticking, which I thought was pretty phenomenal. And just a quick question was that I went to college in St. Louis, and turn of the century, St. Louis was one of the most prominent cities of the modern Olympics and the World's Fair. And then it declined, and I always heard that it declined because the railroads decided that Chicago would be the hub instead of St. Louis. And I just wondered if your author guest had heard anything about that.
Yes, that decision had actually been made before the World's Fair, and the Mississippi River, on which, of course, St. Louis sits, was regarded as one of the great, as it was known, articulation points of American transcontinental rail. That's the place where goods were amassed, broken down into separate parcels and shipped off into the West. And St. Louis and New Orleans, for that matter, were two of the great railway hubs. But Chicago was the undisputed king of railroad traffic.
Read Carl Sandburg. And thank you for that call, Dan. Richard, good luck, by the way, with the project. I should mention that I said earlier that Tom Zellner teaches at Chapman College in Los Angeles, and you know, you think everybody drives a car in Los Angeles, but you go to your classes, you go to school by train.
Yes, it's a wonderful way to travel. There's that sort of central aspect of the train, the landscape rolling by, the kind of movement of the carriages, and it's one of the most civilized ways to get to work. No accident, I think, that Chicago, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, you know, these are train commuter cities.
Most of the train rides to work are still up in the Northeast, aren't they?
Yeah, the Northeast is really where the culture of railroads, you know, breathes the deepest in the United States. In L.A., it's a bit of an anachronism. When I tell people I take the train to work, I get puzzled looks.
Merrily from Oakland writes, what a delight to hear about trains. As a former Zephyrette, I'm not sure what that is.
California Zephyr, yeah.
Oh, okay. Just for a short time while in college, I learned how valuable riding a train can be, especially at the beginning and end of a trip. The rhythm of the rails, along with being trapped for a few days, almost forces one to relax and experience fabulous countryside views. What a joy. And Raman writes on our Facebook page, the future of train travel is quite bright because it is the only practical mode of travel in which no carbon is released into the atmosphere. Therefore, it is a start to combating global warming, assuming the trains are run by electricity or even small nuclear engines. And again, on our Facebook page, Brian writes, Dvorak's music is full of allusions to the sounds of the rails. The New World Symphony incorporates the rhythms and sounds of the rails.
He's quite right. And many classical composers of that era quoted the train, if you like. The most famous is Rhapsody in Blue, which is usually associated with, you know, the Manhattan skyline.
Or with Harlem, as most of Gershwin is often associated with.
Yeah, yeah. But really, George Gershwin first heard Rhapsody in Blue in his own mind when he was taking a train from New York to Boston. And he writes about the train, the rattly bang, as he called it, of being the engine of America's national pep. And the result of that was the composition Rhapsody in Blue.
And we go to another caller. Maria, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. I am originally from Budapest, Hungary. And in 1948, as a child, my father and my stepmother took the train from Budapest to the border and then crossed when the Iron Curtain was going up. And I remember the excitement that train ride was giving me. But, you know, when I went back to Europe lately, the clicks are missing. What happened?
the clicks are typically caused by what are called fish plates. And if you can sort of picture rails as they're joined to one another, there's a tiny little gap in between those lengths of rail, and there's sort of this square metal thing that that holds them together. And because the clicks are gone, that means that the crews have taken the trouble to weld the rails together and eliminated the clicks. And so what you're hearing actually is good railway maintenance.
I wish they didn't, because that was kind of like the music that they are talking about right now. It's part of the music. If you go smoothly, you don't have the music.
You don't
have the rhythm.
You don't. And high-speed rail, for all of its virtues, actually sounds like an airplane more than a railroad.
Yeah, I really miss it. But anyway, that trip brought me over here, so that was a special wonderful experience.
Yeah, well, thank you, Maria. Good to hear from you. And I wanted to actually, we're asking people memorable experiences on train rides and getting some very thoughtful and fascinating responses. Rick writes, my father was a train fan and especially steam-powered trains, which was very much on the wane in my youth. I remember being awakened late one night on a car trip in Ontario to observe a huge steam locomotive with passenger train roaring through an uncontrolled crossing on a snowy night. Even though I was less than 10 years old, it was one of those memories you can never lose, even in the memory-compromised days of old age. And on our Facebook page, Philip writes, my most memorable rail trip was riding trains in the Swiss Alps. The sheer accuracy and perfect timing of their train system is a wonder to behold, along, of course, with the scenery. Rick asks, I wonder what your guest thinks about the slow speed of California high-speed rail. I've read that in France, high-speed rail is being tested. It can travel at 570 kph. It seems that the planned system in California is much slower.
Well, Dan Richard, who was just calling in, could probably better answer this question. I believe that the top speed on California HSR is 186 miles an hour. Right now, we've got 11 stops on the map. There's some thought that that's too many stops in the Central Valley. But rest assured, when it does get built, as I believe it will, it is going to be a fast, incredible ride, 2.5 hours from L.A. to the Bay Area.
More of your calls. We go to Kevin. Kevin, you're on.
Yes, I just wanted to relate a story. When I was younger, I lived in a little town in Idaho in the mid-50s to the late-50s. The economy was basically based on sugar beets and potatoes, and right through the center of town ran the train tracks. We had, at that time, it was all hobos, and they had camps up and down the tracks. And we used to have them coming up to our back door, at our house, asking for food. Very nice. I mean, it was a totally different time. Actually, it was nice memories to behold from the past as compared to now.
Okay.
That's pretty much my comment.
Yeah, thank you for that. Talking about a different America, really, and a different time, obviously, a different era. People get a little scared when they see hobos coming to the back door these days. I imagine.
Right, but in the Depression and prior to that, it was sort of an acceptable means of people getting from place to place. Railroads had sort of a wink and a nod towards it, and it was recognized as an economic reality.
And we'll go to more calls. We'll go to Mark and Benicia. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Really been enjoying the program and looking forward to picking up Tom's book. I've spent a lot of time in Japan, several years living there and traveling there a number of times, and just fascinating with the rail system there, just the way that it manifests so many of the wonderful things about Japanese culture, the orderliness, the precision, the cleanliness. And one time we decided to see if it was possible, and I researched the schedules, and I don't know who else has done this, but I have been a couple of times on all four main islands of Japan within the same day, traveling only by train. And it's possible to do that. Started out early in the morning at Hakata Station on the island of Kyushu, then took the Shinkansen to Okayama, changed trains there, took a slower train across the bridge to the island of Shikoku, and then did a U-turn in Marugame, back to Okayama, to Tokyo, then all the way north on the Shinkansen, and then finally from Aomori, taking a slower train through the Seikan Tunnel to Hakodate on the island of Hokkaido. And so from about 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. was managed to be on all four main islands within the same day, traveling only by rail. And the amazing thing about the schedule there,
Thing is that you remember all those names, Mark, and you pronounce them so fluently sounding.
Well, I do speak a little bit of Japanese. But, that I could be on all four main islands in the same day and that I could plan a trip like that with complete confidence. You know, I've done a similar trip in Japan where I planned a change of trains at Tokyo Station from the Tokaido Shinkansen coming in to the Tohoku Shinkansen going north, and they had a 4-minute change according to the schedule, and yet you can plan that with complete confidence. You know you will have the 4 minutes.
That is not possible on Amtrak.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Mark. Good to hear from you. Here's Al, who writes, when I think beyond the romanticism of trains and lead belly, I think of East of Eden. And we'll go to more calls here. This is Van next up. Van, hi.
Yeah, my brother Michael and me were sent away from my folks, and we went on two routes, the Atlantic coast down to Florida, but the most memorable was on the Pennsylvania Railroad on the Horseshoe Bend and being able to see the headlight of the train that we were traveling on.
When you say sent away, you mean your parents banished you? Or what?
They banished us from Summers so they could enjoy themselves, yes.
Yeah. At what age were you?
13, 12, 8.
Yeah.
It was a long time, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say probably many years ago. But thanks for that memory. And Van, good to hear from you.
For those who love trains, being able to see the locomotive when you're riding in a carriage, when it goes around a curve, I mean, that's kind of the money shot.
It's a big difference, yeah. You were here working for the Chronicle a number of years ago, but I wondered about your knowledge of Bay Area trains, like the Key System and the Gravity Car that's up on Montam?
Oh, yeah. San Francisco has always been kind of a rail lover's paradise. Much of the capital, of course, for the Central Pacific came from here. And it's always been problematic to sort of run a trunk line into the city itself.
Here's Denise. Welcome to Forum. Hi.
Hey, good morning. Yes, I was calling to say that I will look forward to reading this book and that I'm also a train lover. I haven't made it outside the contiguous United States, but that it's emotionally therapeutic, it's spiritually renewing, it's affordable, it's great for people with children because they can't get lost because it's not like a bus stop or anything. They're not going anywhere. There's other kids of all ages, and it's true. It brings out the best in travelers and workers. It's not lonely. You couldn't be alone if you wanted to in the dining car. I have $185 in my Amtrak account because I had to change my plans, so I'm looking forward to going again. And I'm 61 years old, legally blind in a wheelchair, and I love trains, and I have loved trains ever since I got a chance to discover them.
Love your enthusiasm, Denise. Thank you for the call.
And I love the spiritual renewing sort of aspect of it. Yeah, the train is zen.
Here's Helen, who writes, I traveled from Shanghai to Paris by train in June of 1990. After teaching English in Japan for a year, I traveled back to Europe, mostly by train. I took the Trans-Manchurian route of the Trans-Siberian Express. It was a trip of a lifetime. And we're asking for favorite train memories. Let me just give you a few. Johnny says, taking the train with my mother and three brothers from Los Angeles to Chicago many times in the early 60s, when some trains still had wooden seats and no food. That was somewhere in the Arizona area. I love meeting so many different people. The porters were wonderful. I still love trains and follow train art here on Facebook as well as the skunk train up in Mendocino. Thank you. Garrett asks, I was happy to hear you mention Frank Norris. I'm reading The Octopus right now, and I'm curious about the author's take on the novel and the implied corruption.
Oh, well, more than implied. I mean, Frank Norris was going after the Southern Pacific Railroad, and the train itself becomes the visage of the devil in that novel, and writes...
With good reasons.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Southern Pacific was a venomous company that was out to ruthlessly crush competition and destroy communities, and... for lovers of the fiction of outrage, it's hard to beat The Octopus.
Here's another listener who writes about being a train fan, having a couple of memorable trips. I took the California Zephyr from here to Chicago and back. I didn't recognize Zephyrettes. Now I know. All right. Uncomfortable and full of breakdowns and delays, but lots of great stories after. Wouldn't do it again. I've taken the Overlander across the North Island of New Zealand a couple of times. Nice ride. Last time I was in the UK, took the train from London to Penzance. England has great trains. John asks, why do young males have such a fascination with trains and not so with young females?
Sigmund Freud wrote about this, actually. And he, of course, you can guess what he said. And, you know,
a lot of things like that.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Sometimes a locomotive is just a locomotive, right? But what he observed about young boys' fascination with trains remains durable. I mean, you can disagree with his reasoning, but you cannot disagree with the numbers here. Young boys have an absolute fascination with this kind of transportation.
I was asking about local trains. You know about the Sutra train that goes through Land's End?
Land's End?
That went through Land's End, yeah.
Actually, no. This is the Baz at Land's End. It was a Sutro, Adolf Sutro, who I didn't know that he had a railway.
Yeah, he ran a train out there.
That's cool.
Let me get some more calls on. Kaz from Albany. Morning.
Good morning. I had the opportunity to have good experiences and bad with trains. Let me get to the bad first. I was in Sacramento with my family. I was about 5 years old, and we were sent to camps Of course, we were sent on trains to Tule Lake first. Another camp we were sent to was in Arkansas. And the last camp we were sent to was in Colorado.
You're not talking about summer camps. You're talking about internment camps.
Huh? I'm talking about internment camps. That's correct. Uh-huh. And the last camp was Colorado. And from there, there was freedom because we went from there to St. Louis. And St. Louis, we were out of the camps. And I guess the best train ride I had was from leaving the climate of St. Louis for 5 years. You know, I lived there for 10 years, actually. But coming out to California and settling in Berkeley, California, crossing the Sierras, having a wonderful trout breakfast the morning that I was crossing the Sierras, you know, and coming into what I consider home now.
Well, glad you're here and glad you called and sorry you went through that experience. In fact, trains were essentially the main form of transportation to take people off to the death camps in Germany. I mean, to Auschwitz, to Buchenwald, to Dachau.
Yeah, and the caller perfectly summarizes it. You know, there's a lot to celebrate about trains, but they have a dark history in many cases. And yes, there's a chapter in this book where I write about the role of the railroads in the Holocaust. That death on an industrial scale would not have been possible without railroads. And Stalin's gulags also relied on the Trans-Siberian. You know, there's not everything to celebrate here.
You know that FDR has been held up to a lot of criticism for not bombing the railways that were taking Holocaust victims to their deaths.
Yes, and that's certainly something that historians will continue to debate with good reason. You know, the War Department said that if we do that, the Germans are just going to repair those tracks very quickly. So why are we going to, you know, take the risk? But others say, well, you know, we should have done everything in our power to stop those trains.
Here's a listener who writes, my grandparents homesteaded near Clovis, New Mexico in the early 1900s. They, like other farmers and ranchers in the area, used cast-off boxcars for homes and outbuildings. They still had those, including a caboose, when as a child in the 50s and 60s, my cousins and I played in them. The caboose is still there. I can see it from Google Earth. There was no local lumber available, which is why they bought the boxcars and caboose. And Mary writes, in the 1980s, I collected the oral history of the logging railroad to accompany Dave Bone's collection of Darius Kinsey's photographs of the logging railroad in Washington State in the late 19th century, chronicle books, the locomotive portraits. And one thing that Kinsey saw was the community of men who worked on and maintained the locomotives and the enormous pride of the engineers, brakemen, and firemen who ran them. We'll go to another caller, and it's you, Anita. Hi.
Hello. I wanted to tell you about a trip from Budapest via Vienna, 30-some hours to London, with my boyfriend, and at the end of the trip, he told me he would not consider seeing me again because he has just proposed to his girlfriend on the side.
Ooh.
Ouch.
So I'm sorry, it's not a very...
Not a good memory of trains. No.
Good memory, but I do have wonderful memories of train rides in Europe.
Not that one.
Not that one, no.
Yes, trains are associated, of course, with love, but also with heartbreak, too.
Wasn't there a movie called Throw Mama from the Train?
There was.
Danny DeVito, I think.
Yeah. Sort of predicted the expression to throw someone under the bus.
We'll get another caller on. Leslie, hi.
I wanted to relay a story of my mother. She's no longer alive. During World War II, she went from New Orleans to Kentucky for boarding school with her sister, and whoever took her or took them, they would wear a pair of white gloves, and another set would be taken because when they got on the train, they would be white, but when they arrived at their destination in Kentucky, they would be black from soot. So there would be a new pair of gloves to be put on so they would be presentable when they arrived at the boarding school.
Well, thank you for that, Leslie. It also reminds me of there's a passage in a novel of Toni Morrison's called Sulu where one of the main characters, Nell, is going back on a train and has this confrontation with a porter. And it's actually very compelling because, you know, there was segregation and they weren't supposed to be sitting where she wasn't supposed to be sitting where she was sitting. And she's made to feel, even though she's a very well-dressed, you know, white gloves and fine, high-standard woman, she's made to feel essentially like a victim of the apartheid and Jim Crow that existed then.
You know, no less a character than a historical figure than Gandhi had his civil rights consciousness sort of sealed when he was thrown out of the first-class compartment of a train through South Africa. And it was the moment that
a seminal moment, really.
Yeah, for him and his thinking about ways of fighting this injustice. Prior to that, he was just embarked on an ordinary course of being a lawyer.
Quick question for you from Tom. What does your guest think of the future of Amtrak? Remember the Bush administration trying to shut down the long-haul routes in the West?
Yeah, Ronald Reagan, made Amtrak kind of a favorite whipping boy, and he always tried to kill it, you know, but always ran into resistance from hometown senators who would defend these routes as though they were sort of their own private trains. You know, Robert Byrd is the one that we can thank for continuing service through West Virginia, and certainly the Vermonter would not exist without Senator Patrick Leahy.
Quick question from Stephen, California. He says is quietly having a rail renaissance. The Surfliner is second only to Northeast Corridor and ridership in the United States. Is that true?
I have not seen that figure, but the caller is correct that there is enormous latent demand for rail travel in Southern California.
And can you, before we say goodbye to you, recommend a starter train trip for newbies?
Oh, if you have the time, by all means, get on the aforementioned California Zephyr. Take it to Chicago through the Rockies. You're not going to be disappointed.
The book, again, is Train. It's by Tom Zellner. He'll be at Town Center Books in Pleasanton at 7 o'clock. Go out with a little Rhapsody in Blue, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.